The game ended by attrition, not by any cleverness. The last boy simply happened to be the least stupid in his use of his ships. Bean watched as they reset the game. No one put in a coin. The games here were free. Bean watched another game. It was just as quick as the first, as each boy committed his ships clumsily, forgetting about whichever one was not actively engaged. It was as if they thought of their force as one active ship and three reserves. Maybe the controls didn't allow anything different. Bean moved closer. No, it was possible to set the course for one, flip to control another ship and another, then return to the first ship to change its course at any time. How did these boys get into battle school if this was all they could think of? Bean had never played a computer game before, but he saw at once that any competent player could quickly win if this was the best competition available. "Hey, dwarf, want to play?" One of them had noticed him. Of course, the others did, too. "Yes," said Bean. "Well, bugger that," said the one who invited him. "Who do you think you are, Ender Wiggin?" They laughed, and then all four of them walked away from the game, heading for their next class. The room was empty. Class time. Ender Wiggin. The kids in the corridor talked about him, too. Something about Bean made these kids think of Ender Wiggin. Sometimes with admiration, sometimes with resentment. This Ender must have beaten some older kids at a computer game or something. And he was at the top of the standings. That's what somebody said. Standings in what? The kids in the same uniform, running like one crew, heading for a fight. That was the central fact of life here. There was one core game that everyone played. They lived in barracks according to what team they were on. Every kid's standings were reported so everybody else knew them. And whatever the game was, the adults ran it. So this was the shape of life here. And this Ender Wiggin, whoever he was at the top of it all. He led the standings. Bean reminded people of him. That made him a little proud, yes, but it also annoyed him. It was safer not to be noticed. But because this other small kid had done brilliantly, everybody who saw Bean thought of Ender, and that made Bean memorable. That would limit his freedom considerably. There was no way to disappear here as he had been able to disappear in crowds in Rotterdam. Well, who cared? He couldn't be hurt now, not really. No matter what happened, as long as he was here at battle school, he would never be hungry. He'd always have shelter. He had made it to heaven. All he had to do was the minimum required to not get sent home early. So who cared if people noticed him or not? It made no difference. Let them worry about their standings. Bean had already won the battle for survival, and after that, no other competition mattered. But even as he had that thought, he knew it wasn't true. Because he did care. It wasn't enough just to survive. It never had been. Deeper than his need for food had been his hunger for order, for finding out how things worked, getting a grasp on the world around him. When he was starving, of course he used what he learned in order to get himself into Poke's crew and get her crew enough food that there would be enough to trickle some down to him at the bottom of the pecking order. But even when Ashiel had turned them into his family, and they had something to eat every day, Bean hadn't stopped being alert, trying to understand the changes, the dynamics in the group. Even with Sister Carlotta, he had spent a lot of effort trying to understand why and how she had the power to do for him what she was doing, and the basis on which she had chosen him. He had to know. He had to have the picture of everything in his mind. Here, too. He could have gone back to the barracks and napped. Instead, he risked getting in trouble just to find out things that no doubt he would have learned in the ordinary course of events. Why did I come up here? What was I looking for? The key. The world was full of locked doors, and he had to get his hands on every key. He stood still and listened. The room was nearly silent. But there was white noise, background rumble and hiss that made it so sounds didn't carry throughout the entire station. With his eyes closed, he located the source of the faint rushing sound. Eyes open, he then walked to where the vent was. An outflowing vent with slightly warmer air making a very slight breeze. The rushing sound was not the hiss of air here at the vent, but rather a much louder, more distant sound of the machinery that pumped air throughout the battle school. Sister Carlotta had told him that in space there was no air, so wherever people lived, they had to keep their ships and stations closed tight, holding in every bit of air. And they also had to keep changing the air because the oxygen, she said, got used up and had to be replenished. That's what this air system was about. It must go everywhere through the ship. Bean sat before the vent screen, feeling around the edges. There were no visible screws or nails holding it on. He got his fingernails under the rim and carefully slid his fingers around it, prying it out a little, then a little more. His fingers now fit under the edges. He pulled straight forward. The vent came free and Bean toppled over backward. Only for a moment. He set aside the screen and tried to see into the vent. The vent duct was only about 15 centimeters deep from front to back. The top was solid, but the bottom was open, leading down into the duct system. Bean sized up the vent opening just the way he had years before, stood on the seat of a toilet, and studied the inside of the toilet tank, deciding whether he could fit in it. And the conclusion was the same. It would be cramped, it would be painful, but he could do it. He reached an arm inside and down. He couldn't feel the bottom. But with arms as short as his, that didn't mean much. There was no way to tell by looking which way the duct went when it got down to the floor level. Bean could imagine a duct leading under the floor, but that felt wrong to him. Sister Carlotta had said that every scrap of material used to build the station had to be hauled up from Earth or the manufacturing plants on the moon. They wouldn't have big gaps between the decks and the ceilings below, because that would be wasted space into which precious air would have to be pumped without anyone breathing it. No, the ductwork would be in the outside walls. It was probably no more than 15 centimeters deep anywhere. He closed his eyes and imagined an air system. Machinery making a warm wind blow through the narrow ducts, flowing into every room, carrying fresh, breathable air everywhere? No, that wouldn't work. There had to be a place where the air was getting sucked in and drawn back. And if the air blew in at the outside walls, then the intake would be in the corridors. Bean got up and ran to the door of the game room. Sure enough, the corridor ceiling was at least 20 centimeters lower than the ceiling inside the room. But no vents, just light fixtures. He stepped back into the room and looked up. All along the top of the wall that bordered on the corridor, there was a narrow vent that looked more decorative than practical. The opening was about 3 centimeters. Not even Bean could fit through the intake system. He ran back to the open vent and took off his shoes. No reason to get hung up because his feet were so much bigger than they needed to be. He faced the vent and swung his feet down into the opening. Then he wriggled until his legs were entirely down the hole and his buttocks rested on the rim of the vent. His feet still hadn't found bottom. Not a good sign. What if the vent dropped straight down into the machinery? He wriggled back out, then went in the other way. It was harder and more painful, but now his arms were more usable, giving him a good grip on the floor as he slid chest deep into the hole. His feet touched bottom. Using his toes, he probed. Yes, the ductwork ran to the left and the right along the outside wall of the room, and the opening was tall enough that he could slide down into it, then wriggle, always on his side, along from room to room. That was all he needed to know at present. He gave a little jump so his arms reached farther out onto the floor, meaning to use friction to let him pull himself up. Instead, he just slid back down into the vent. Oh, this was excellent. Someone would come looking for him eventually, or he'd be found by the next batch of kids who came in to play games, but he did not want to be found like this. More to the point, the ductwork would only give him an alternate route through the station if he could climb out of the vents. He had a mental image of somebody opening a vent and seeing his skull looking out at them, his dead body completely dried up in the warm wind of the air ducts where he starved to death or died of thirst trying to get out of the vents. As long as he was just standing there, though, he might as well find out if he could cover the vent opening from the inside. He reached over and, with difficulty, got a finger on the screen and was able to pull it toward him. Once he got a hand solidly on it, it wasn't hard at all to get it over the opening. He could even pull it in, tightly enough that it probably wouldn't be noticeably different to casual observers on the other side. With the vent closed, though, he had to keep his head turned to one side. There wasn't room enough for him to turn it. So once he got in the duct system, his head would either stay turned to the left or to the right. Great. He pushed the vent back out, but carefully, so that it didn't fall to the floor. Now it was time to climb out in earnest. After a couple more failures, he finally realized that the screen was exactly the tool he needed. Laying it down on the floor in front of the vent, he hooked his fingers under the far end. Pulling back on the screen provided him with the leverage to lift his body far enough to get his chest over the rim of the vent opening. It hurt to hang the weight of his body on such a sharp edge, but now he could get up on his elbows and then on his hands, lifting his whole body up through the opening and back into the room. He thought carefully through the sequence of muscles he had used and then thought about the equipment in the gym. Yes, he could strengthen those muscles. He put the vent screen back into place. Then he pulled up his shirt and looked at the red marks on his skin where the rim of the vent opening had scraped him mercilessly. There was some blood. Interesting. How would he explain it if anyone asked? He'd have to see if he could re-injure the same spot by climbing around on the bunks later. He jogged out of the game room and down the corridor to the nearest pole, then dropped to the mess hall level. All the way he wondered why he had felt such urgency about getting into the ducts. Whenever he got like that in the past, doing some task without knowing why it even mattered, it had turned out that there was a danger that he had sensed, but that hadn't yet risen to his conscious mind. What was the danger here? Then he realized. In Rotterdam, out on the street, he had always made sure he knew a back way out of everything, an alternate path to get from one place to another. If he was running from someone, he never dodged into a cul-de-sac to hide unless he knew another way out. In truth, he never really hid at all. He evaded pursuit by keeping on the move, always. No matter how awful the danger following him might be, he could not hold still. It felt terrible to be cornered. It hurt. It hurt. And was wet and cold, and he was hungry, and there wasn't enough air to breathe, and people walked by, and if they just lifted the lid, they would find him, and he had no way to run if they did that. He just had to sit there waiting for them to pass without noticing him. If they used the toilet and flushed it, the equipment wouldn't work right because the whole weight of his body was pressing down on the float. A lot of the water had spilled out of the tank when he climbed in. They'd notice something was wrong, and they'd find him. It was the worst experience of his life, and he couldn't stand the idea of ever hiding like that again. It wasn't the small space that bothered him, or that it was wet, or that he was hungry or alone. It was the fact that the only way out was into the arms of his pursuers. Now that he understood that about himself, he could relax. He hadn't found the ductwork because he sensed some danger that hadn't yet risen to his conscious mind. He found the ductwork because he remembered how bad it felt to hide in the toilet tank as a toddler. So whatever danger there might be, he hadn't sensed it yet. It was just a childhood memory coming to the surface. Sister Carlotta had told him that a lot of human behavior was really acting out our responses to dangers long past. It hadn't sounded sensible to Bean at the time, but he didn't argue, and now he could see that she was right. And how could he know there would never be a time when that narrow, dangerous highway through the ductwork might not be exactly the route he needed to save his life? He never did palm the wall to light up green, brown, green. He knew exactly where his barracks was. How could he not? He had been there before and knew every step between the barracks and every other place he had visited in the station. And when he got there, Dymac had not yet returned with the slow eaters. His whole exploration hadn't taken more than 20 minutes, including his conversation with Petra and watching 2 quick computer games during the class break. He awkwardly hoisted himself up from the lower bunk, dangling for a while from his chest on the rim of the second bunk. Long enough that it hurt in pretty much the same spot he had injured climbing out of the vent. "What are you doing?" asked one of the launchies near him. Since the truth wouldn't be understood, he answered truthfully. "Injuring my chest?" he said. "I'm trying to sleep," said the other boy. "You're supposed to sleep too." "Nap time," said another boy. "I feel like I'm some stupid 4-year-old. Bean wondered vaguely what these boys' lives had been like when taking a nap made them think of being 4 years old.
Sister Carlotta stood beside Pablo de Noches, looking at the toilet tank.
"Old-fashioned kind," said Pablo. "Norte Americano. Very popular for a while back when the Netherlands first became international."
She lifted the lid on the toilet tank. Very light. Plastic. As they came out of the lavatory, the office manager who had been showing them around looked at her curiously. "There's not any kind of danger from using the toilets, is there?" she asked.
"No," said Sister Carlotta. "I just had to see it, that's all. It's fleet business. I'd appreciate it if you didn't talk about our visit here." Of course, that almost guaranteed that she would talk about nothing else. But Sister Carlotta counted on it sounding like nothing more than strange gossip. Whoever had run an organ farm in this building would not want to be discovered, and there was a lot of money in such evil businesses. That was how the devil rewarded his friends. Lots of money, up to the moment he betrayed them, and left them to face the agony of hell alone. Outside the building, she spoke again to Pablo. "He really hid in there?"
"He was very tiny," said Pablo de Noches. "He was crawling when I found him, but he was soaking wet up to his shoulder on one side, and his chest. I thought he peed himself, but he said no. Then he showed me the toilet. And he was red, here, here, where he pressed against the mechanism."
"He was talking?" she said.
Not a lot. A few words."
"So tiny. I could not believe a child so small could talk. How long was he in there?"
Pablo shrugged.
"Shriveled up skin like old lady. All over. Cold. I was thinking, he will die. Not warm water like a swimming pool. Cold. He shivered all night."
"I can't understand why he didn't die," said Sister Carlotta. Pablo smiled.
"No hay nada que Dios no puede hacer."
"True," she answered. "But that doesn't mean we can't figure out how God works his miracles. Or why." Pablo shrugged.
"God does what he does. I do my work and live, the best man I can be."
She squeezed his arm. "You took in a lost child and saved him from people who meant to kill him. God saw you do that, and he loves you." Pablo said nothing, but Sister Carlotta could guess what he was thinking. How many sins, exactly, were washed away by that good act, and would it be enough to keep him out of hell? "Good deeds do not wash away sins," said Sister Carlotta.
Solo el Redentor puede limpiar su alma.
Pablo shrugged. Theology was not his skill.
You don't do good deeds for yourself, said Sister Carlotta. You do them because God is in you, and for those moments you are his hands and his feet, his eyes and his lips.
I thought God was the baby. Jesus say, if you do it to this little one, you do it to me.
Sister Carlotta laughed. God will sort out all the fine points in his own due time. It is enough that we try to serve him.
He was so small, said Pablo, but God was in him.
She bade him goodbye as he got out of the taxi in front of his apartment building. Why did I have to see that toilet with my own eyes? My work with Bean is done. He left on the shuttle yesterday. Why can't I leave the matter alone?
Because he should have been dead, that's why. And after starving on the streets for all those years, even if he lived, he was so malnourished, he should have suffered serious mental damage. He should have been permanently retarded. That was why she could not abandon the question of Bean's origin. Because maybe he was damaged. Maybe he is retarded. Maybe he started out so smart that he could lose half his intellect and still be the miraculous boy he is. She thought of how St. Matthew kept saying that all the things that happened in Jesus' childhood, his mother treasured them in her heart. Bean is not Jesus, and I am not the Holy Mother. But he is a boy, and I have loved him as my son. What he did, no child of that age could do. No child of less than a year, not yet walking by himself, could have such clear understanding of his danger that he would know to do the things that Bean did. Children that age often climbed out of their cribs, but they did not hide in a toilet tank for hours and then come out alive and ask for help. I can call it a miracle all I want, but I have to understand it. They use the dregs of the earth in those organ farms. Bean has such extraordinary gifts that he could only have come from extraordinary parents. And yet for all her research during the months that Bean lived with her, she had never found a single kidnapping that could possibly have been Bean. No abducted child. Not even an accident from which someone might have taken a surviving infant whose body was therefore never found. That wasn't proof. Not every baby that disappeared left a trace of his life in the newspapers, and not every newspaper was archived and available for a search on the nets. But Bean had to be the child of parents so brilliant that the world took note of them, didn't he? Could a mind like his come from ordinary parents? Was that the miracle from which all other miracles flowed? No matter how much Sister Carlotta tried to believe it, she could not. Bean was not what he seemed to be. He was in battle school now, and there was a good chance he would end up someday as the commander of a great fleet. But what did anyone know about him? Was it possible that he was not a natural human being at all? That his extraordinary intelligence had been given him not by God, but by someone or something else? There was the question. If not God, then who could make such a child? Sister Carlotta buried her face in her hands. Where did such thoughts come from? After all these years of searching, why did she have to keep doubting the one great success she had?
We have seen the beast of Revelation, she said silently. The bugger, the formic monster bringing destruction to the earth, just as prophesied. We have seen the beast,
And long ago Maser Rackham and the human fleet, on the brink of defeat, slew that great dragon. But it will come again, and St. John the Revelator said that when it did, there would be a prophet who came with him. No, no. Bean is good, a good-hearted boy. He is not any kind of devil, not the servant of the beast, just a boy of great gifts that God may have raised up to bless this world in the hour of its greatest peril. I know him as a mother knows her child. I am not wrong. Yet when she got back to her room, she set her computer to work, searching now for something new, for reports from or about scientists who had been working, at least 5 years ago, on projects involving alterations in human DNA. And while the search program was querying all the great indexes on the nets and sorting their replies into useful categories, Sister Carlotta went to the neat little pile of folded clothing waiting to be washed. She would not wash it, after all. She put it in a plastic bag, along with Bean's sheets and pillowcase, and sealed the bag. Bean had worn this clothing, slept on this bedding. His skin was in it, small bits of it, a few hairs, maybe enough DNA for a serious analysis. He was a miracle, yes, but she would find out just what the dimensions of this miracle might be. For her ministry had not been to save the children of the cruel streets of the cities of the world. Her ministry had been to help save the one species made in the image of God. That was still her ministry. And if there was something wrong with the child she had taken into her heart as a beloved son, she would find out about it and give warning.
Chapter 7. Exploration.
So this launch group was slow getting back to their barracks.
There is a 21-minute discrepancy.
Is that a lot? I didn't even know this sort of thing was tracked.
For safety, and to have an idea in the event of emergency where everyone is. Tracking the uniforms that departed from the mess hall and the uniforms that entered the barracks, we come up with an aggregate of 21 minutes. That could be 21 children loitering for exactly 1 minute, or one child for 21 minutes.
That's very helpful. Am I supposed to ask them?
No, they aren't supposed to know that we track them by their uniforms. It isn't good for them to know how much we know about them.
And how little.
Little?
If it was one student, it wouldn't be good for him to know that our tracking methods don't tell us who it was.
Oh, good point. And actually, I came to you because I believe that it was one student only.
Even though your data aren't clear?
Because of the arrival pattern, spaced out in groups of two or three, a few solos, just the way they left the mess hall. A little bit of clumping, three solos become a threesome, two twos arrive as four. But if there had been some kind of major distraction in the corridor, it would have caused major coalescing, a much larger group arriving at once after the disturbance ended.
So, one student with 21 minutes unaccounted for.
I thought you should at least be aware.
What would he do with 21 minutes?
You know who it was?
I will. Soon enough. Are the toilets tracked? Are we sure it wasn't somebody so nervous he went in to throw up his lunch?
Toilet entry and exit patterns were normal. In and out.
Yes. I'll find out who it was. And keep watching the data for this launch group.
So I was right to bring this to your attention?
Did you have any doubt of it?
Bean slept lightly, listening as he always did, waking twice that he remembered. He didn't get up, just lay there listening to the breathing of the others. Both times there was a little whispering somewhere in the room. Always children's voices, no urgency about them, but the sound was enough to rouse Bean and kindle his attention, just for a moment till he was sure there was no danger. He woke the third time when Dymac entered the room. Even before sitting up, Bean knew that's who it was, from the weight of his step, the sureness of his movement, the press of authority. Bean's eyes were open before Dymac spoke. He was on all fours, ready to move in any direction before Dymac finished his first sentence. "Nap time is over, boys and girls. Time for work." It was not about Bean. If Dymac knew what Bean had done after lunch and before their nap, he gave no sign. No immediate danger. Bean sat on his bunk as Dymac instructed them in the use of their lockers and desks. Palm the wall beside the locker and it opens. Then turn on the desk and enter your name and a password. Bean immediately palmed his own locker with his right hand, but did not palm the desk. Instead, he checked on Dymac, busy helping another student near the door, then scrambled to the unoccupied third bunk above his own and palmed that locker with his left hand. There was a desk inside that one, too. Quickly, he turned on his own desk and typed in his name and a password. Bean. Ashiel. Then he pulled out the other desk and turned it on. Name? Poke. Password? Carlotta. He slipped the second desk back into the locker and closed the door, then tossed his first desk down onto his own bunk and slipped down after it. He did not look around to see if anyone noticed him. If they did, they'd say something soon enough. Visibly checking around would merely call attention to him and make people suspect him who would not otherwise have noticed what he did. Of course, the adults would know what he had done. In fact, Dymac was certainly noticing already when one child complained that his locker wouldn't open. So the station computer knew how many students there were and stopped opening lockers when the right total had been opened. But Dymac did not turn and demand to know who had opened two lockers. Instead, he pressed his own palm against the last student's locker. It popped open. He closed it again, and now it responded to the student's palm. So they were going to let him have his second locker, his second desk, his second identity. No doubt they would watch him with special interest to see what he did with it. He would have to make a point of fiddling with it now and then, clumsily, so they'd think they knew what he wanted a second identity for. Maybe some kind of prank. Or to write down secret thoughts. That would be fun. Sister Carlotta was always prying after his secret thoughts, and no doubt these teachers would too. Whatever he wrote, they'd eat it up. Therefore, they wouldn't be looking for his truly private work, which he would perform on his own desk. Or, if it was risky, on the desk of one of the boys across from him, both of whose passwords he had carefully noticed and memorized. Dymac was lecturing them about protecting their desks at all times, but it was inevitable that kids would be careless and desks would be left lying around. For now, though, Bean would do nothing riskier than what he had already done. The teachers had their own reasons for letting him do it. What mattered is that they not know his own. After all, he didn't know himself. It was like the vent. If he thought of something that might get him some advantage later, he did it. Dymac went on talking about how to submit homework, the directory of teachers' names, and the fantasy game that was on every desk. "You are not to spend study time playing the game," he said. "But when your studies are done, you are permitted a few minutes to explore." Bean understood at once. The teachers wanted the students to play the game and knew that the best way to encourage it was to put strict limits on it and then not enforce them. A game. Sister Carlotta had used games to try to analyze Bean from time to time. So Bean always turned them into the same game. "Try to figure out what Sister Carlotta is trying to learn from the way I play this game." In this case, though, Bean figured that anything he did with the game would tell them things that he didn't want them to know about him. So he would not play at all unless they compelled him. And maybe not even then. It was one thing to joust with Sister Carlotta. Here they no doubt had real experts, and Bean was not going to give them a chance to learn more about him than he knew himself. Dymac took them on the tour, showing them most of what Bean had already seen. The other kids went ape over the game room. Bean did not so much as glance at the vent into which he had climbed, though he did make it a point to fiddle with the game he had watched the bigger boys play, figuring out how the controls worked and verifying that his tactics could in fact be carried out. They did a workout in the gym in which Bean immediately began working on the exercises that he thought he'd need. One-armed push-ups and pull-ups being the most important, though they had to get a stool for him to stand on in order to reach the lowest chinning bar. No problem. Soon enough he'd be able to jump to reach it. With all the food they were giving him, he could build up strength quickly. And they seemed grimly determined to pack food into him at an astonishing rate. After the gym, they showered, and then it was supper time. Bean wasn't even hungry yet, and they piled enough food onto his tray to feed his whole crew back in Rotterdam. Bean immediately headed for a couple of the kids who had whined about their small portions, and without even asking permission, scraped his excess onto their trays. When one of them tried to talk to him about it, Bean just put his finger to his lips. In answer, the boy grinned. Bean still ended up with more food than he wanted, but when he turned in his tray, it was scraped clean. The nutritionist would be happy. It remained to be seen if the janitors would report the food Bean left on the floor. Free time. Bean headed back to the game room, hoping that tonight he'd actually see the famous Ender Wiggin. If he was there, he would no doubt be the center of a group of admirers. But at the center of the groups he saw were only the ordinary prestige-hungry clique formers who thought they were leaders and so would follow their group anywhere in order to maintain that delusion. No way could any of them be Ender Wiggin. And Bean was not about to ask. Instead, he tried his hand at several games. Each time, though, the moment he lost for the first time, other kids would push him out of the way. It was an interesting set of social rules. The students knew that even the shortest, greenest launchy was entitled to his turn. But the moment a turn ended, so did the protection of the rule. And they were rougher in shoving him than they needed to be, so the message was clear. You shouldn't have been using that game and making me wait. Just like the food lines at the charity kitchens in Rotterdam. Except that absolutely nothing that mattered was at stake. That was interesting. To find that it wasn't hunger that caused children to become bullies on the street. The bulliness was already in the child, and whatever the stakes were, they would find a way to act as they needed to act. If it was about food, then the children who lost would die. If it was about games, though, the bullies did not hesitate to be just as intrusive and send the same message. Do what I want, or pay for it. Intelligence and education, which all these children had, apparently didn't make any important difference in human nature. Not that Bean had really thought they would. Nor did the low stakes make any difference in Bean's response to the bullies. He simply complied without complaint and took note of who the bullies were. Not that he had any intention of punishing them or of avoiding them either. He would simply remember who acted as a bully and take that into account when he was in a situation where that information might be important. No point in getting emotional about anything. Being emotional didn't help with survival. What mattered was to learn everything, analyze the situation, choose a course of action, and then move boldly. Know, think, choose, do. There was no place in that list for feel. Not that Bean didn't have feelings. He simply refused to think about them, or dwell on them, or let them influence his decisions when anything important was at stake. He's even smaller than Ender was. Again. Again. Bean was so tired of hearing that. Don't talk about that hijo de puta to me, bicho. Bean perked up. Ender had an enemy. Bean was wondering when he'd spot one, for someone who was first in the standings had to have provoked something besides admiration. Who said it? Bean drifted nearer to the group the conversation had come from. The same voice came up again. Again. And then he knew. That one was the boy who had called Ender an hijo de puta. He had the silhouette of some kind of lizard on his uniform, and a single triangle on his sleeve. None of the boys around him had the triangle. All were focused on him. Captain of the team? Bean needed more information. He tugged on the sleeve of a boy standing near him. What? Said the boy, annoyed. Who's that boy there? Asked Bean. The team captain with the lizard. It's a salamander, Pinhead. Salamander Army, and he's the commander. Teams are called armies. Commander is the triangle rank. What's his name? Bonzo Madrid. And he's an even bigger asshole than you. The boy shrugged himself away from Bean. So Bonzo Madrid was bold enough to declare his hatred for Ender Wiggin, but a kid who was not in Bonzo's army had contempt for him in turn and wasn't afraid to say so to a stranger. Good to know. The only enemy Ender had, so far, was contemptible. But, contemptible as Bonzo might be, he was a commander. Which meant it was possible to become a commander without being the kind of boy that everybody respected. So what was their standard of judgment in assigning command in this war game that shaped the life of Battle School? More to the point, how do I get a command? That was the first moment that Bean realized that he even had such a goal. Here in Battle School, he had arrived with the highest scores in his launch group. But he was the smallest and youngest and had been isolated even further by the deliberate actions of his teacher, making him a target of resentment. Somehow, in the midst of all this, Bean had made the decision that this would not be like Rotterdam. He was not going to live on the fringes, inserting himself only when it was absolutely essential for his own survival. As rapidly as possible, he was going to put himself in place to command an army. Ashiel had ruled because he was brutal, because he was willing to kill. That would always trump intelligence when the intelligent one was physically smaller and had no strong allies. But here the bullies only shoved and spoke rudely. The adults controlled things tightly, and so brutality would not prevail, not in the assignment of command. Intelligence, then, had a chance to win out. Eventually, Bean might not have to live under the control of stupid people. If this was what Bean wanted, and why not try for it as long as some more important goal didn't come along first, then he had to learn how the teachers made their decisions about command. Was it solely based on performance in classes? Bean doubted it. The International Fleet had to have smarter people than that running this school. The fact that they had that fantasy game on every desk suggested that they were looking at personality as well. Character. In the end, Bean suspected, character mattered more than intelligence. In Bean's litany of survival, know, think, choose, do, intelligence only mattered in the first three and was the decisive factor only in the second one. The teachers knew that. Maybe I should play the game, thought Bean. Then, not yet. Let's see what happens when I don't play. At the same time, he came to another conclusion he did not even know he had been concerned about. He would talk to Bonzo Madrid.
Bonzo was in the middle of a computer game, and he was obviously the kind of person who thought of anything unexpected as an affront to his dignity. That meant that for Bean to accomplish what he wanted, he could not approach Bonzo in a cringing way, like the suck-ups who surrounded him as he played, commending him even for his stupid mistakes in gameplay. Instead, Bean pushed close enough to see when Bonzo's on-screen character died. Again. Señor Madrid, ¿puedo hablar con vosco? The Spanish came to mind easily enough. He had listened to Pablo de Noches talk to fellow immigrants in Rotterdam who visited his apartment, and on the telephone to family members back in Valencia. And using Bonzo's native language had the desired effect. He didn't ignore Bean. He turned and glared at him.
What do you want, Bichinho?
Brazilian slang was common in Battle School, and Bonzo apparently felt no need to assert the purity of his Spanish. Bean looked him in the eye, even though he was about twice Bean's height, and said,
"People keep saying that I remind them of Ender Wiggin, and you're the only person around here who doesn't seem to worship him. I want to know the truth."
The way the other kids fell silent told Bean that he had judged aright. It was dangerous to ask Bonzo about Ender Wiggin. Dangerous, But that's why Bean had phrased his request so carefully.
Damn right I don't worship the fart-eating, insubordinate traitor. But why should I tell you about him?
Because you won't lie to me, said Bean, though he actually thought it was obvious Bonzo would probably lie outrageously in order to make himself look like the hero of what was obviously a story of his own humiliation at Ender's hands.
And if people are going to keep comparing me to the guy, I've got to know what he really is. I don't want to get iced because I do it all wrong here. You don't owe me nothing. But when you're small like me, you gots to have somebody who can tell you the stuff you gots to know to survive.
Bean wasn't quite sure of the slang here yet, but what he knew, he used. One of the other kids chimed in as if Bean had written him a script and he was right on cue.
Get lost, Launchy. Bonzo Madrid doesn't have time to change diapers.
Bean rounded on him and said fiercely, I can't ask the teachers. They don't tell the truth. If Bonzo don't talk to me, who I ask then? You? You don't know zits from zeros. It was pure sergeant, that spiel, and it worked. Everybody laughed at the kid who had tried to brush him off, and Bonzo joined in, then put a hand on Bean's shoulder.
I'll tell you what I know, kid. It's about time somebody wanted to hear the truth about that walking rectum.
To the kid that Bean had just fronted, Bonzo said, Maybe you better finish my game. It's the only way you'll ever get to play at that level.
Bean could hardly believe a commander would say such a pointlessly offensive thing to one of his own subordinates. But the boy swallowed his anger and grinned and nodded and said, That's right, Bonzo, and turned to the game, as instructed. A real suck-up.
By chance, Bonzo led him to stand right in front of the wall vent where Bean had been stuck only a few hours before. Bean gave it no more than a glance.
Let me tell you about Ender. He's all about beating the other guy. Not just winning. He has to beat the other guy into the ground or he isn't happy. No rules for him. You give him a plain order and he acts like he's going to obey it, but if he sees a way to make himself look good and all he has to do is disobey the order, well, all I can say is I pity whoever has him in his army.
He used to be Salamander? Bonzo's face reddened.
He wore a uniform with our colors. His name was on my roster, but he was never Salamander. The minute I saw him, I knew he was trouble. That cocky look on his face, like he thinks the whole battle school was made just to give him a place to strut. I wasn't having it. I put in to transfer him the second he showed up, and I refused to let him practice with us. I knew he'd learn our whole system and then take it to some other army and use what he learned from me to stick it to my army as fast as he could. I'm not stupid.
In Bean's experience, that was a sentence never uttered except to prove its own inaccuracy. So he didn't follow orders.
It's more than that. He goes crying like a baby to the teachers about how I don't let him practice, even though they know I've put in to transfer him out. But he whines, and they let him go into the battle room during free time and practice alone. Only he starts getting kids from his launch group, and then kids from other armies, and they go in there as if he was their commander, doing what he tells them.
That really pissed off a lot of us.
And the teachers always give that little suck-up whatever he wants, so when we commanders demanded that they bar our soldiers from practicing with him, they just said, free time is free. But everything is part of the game, sabe? Everything. So they're letting him cheat, and every lousy soldier and sneaky little bastard goes to Ender for those free time practices, so every army system is compromised, sabe? You plan your strategy for a game, and you never know if your plans aren't being told to a soldier in the enemy army the second they come out of your mouth, sabe?
Sabe, sabe, sabe. Bean wanted to shout back at him, see, yo sé. But you couldn't show impatience with Bonzo. Besides, this was all fascinating. Bean was getting a pretty good picture of how this army game shaped the life of battle school. It gave the teachers a chance to see how the kids not only handled command, but also how they responded to incompetent commanders like Bonzo. Apparently, he had decided to make Ender the goat of his army, only Ender refused to take it.
This Ender Wiggin was the kind of kid who got it that the teachers ran everything and used them by getting that practice room. He didn't ask them to get Bonzo to stop picking on him. He asked them for an alternate way to train himself. Smart. The teachers had to love that. And Bonzo couldn't do a thing about it. Or could he? What did you do about it? It's what we're going to do. I'm about fed up. If the teachers won't stop it, somebody else will have to, ne? Bonzo grinned wickedly. So I'd stay out of Ender Wiggin's free time practice if I were you. Is he really number one in the standings? Number one is piss, said Bonzo. He's dead last in loyalty. There's not a commander who wants him in his army. Thanks, said Bean. Only now it kind of pisses me off that people say I'm like him. Just because you're small. They made him a soldier when he was still way too young. Don't let them do that to you and you'll be okay, sabe? They ought to say, said Bean. He gave Bonzo his biggest grin. Bonzo smiled back and clapped him on the shoulder. You'll do okay. When you get big enough, if I haven't graduated yet, maybe you'll be in Salamander. If they leave you in command of an army for another day, it's just so that the other students can learn how to make the best of taking orders from a higher-ranking idiot. I'm not going to be a soldier for a long time, said Bean. Work hard, said Bonzo. It pays off. He clapped him on the shoulder yet again, then walked off with a big grin on his face. Proud of having helped a little kid. Glad to have convinced somebody of his own twisted version of dealing with Ender Wiggin, who was obviously smarter farting than Bonzo was talking. And there was a threat of violence against the kids who practiced with Ender Wiggin in free time. That was good to know. Bean would have to decide now what to do with that information. Get the warning to Ender. Warn the teachers. Say nothing. Be there to watch. Free time ended. The game room cleared out as everyone headed to their barracks for the time officially dedicated to independent study. Quiet time, in other words. For most of the kids in Bean's launch group, though, there was nothing to study. They hadn't had any classes yet. So for tonight, study meant playing the fantasy game on their desks and bantering with each other to assert position. Everybody's desk popped up with the suggestion that they could write letters home to their families. Some of the kids chose to do that, and no doubt they all assumed that's what Bean was doing. But he was not. He signed on to his first desk as Poke and discovered that, as he suspected, it didn't matter which desk he used, it was the name and password that determined everything. He would never have to pull that second desk out of its locker. Using the Poke identity, he wrote a journal entry. This was not unexpected. Diary was one of the options on the desk. What should he be? A whiner? Everybody pushed me out of the way in the game room just because I'm little. It isn't fair. A baby? I miss Sister Carlotta so much. I wish I could be in my own room back in Rotterdam. Ambitious. I'll get the best scores on everything. They'll see. In the end, he decided on something a little more subtle. What would a shield do if he were me? Of course, he's not little, but with his bad leg, it's almost the same thing. A shield always knew how to wait and not show them anything. That's what I've got to do, too. Just wait and see what pops up. Nobody's going to want to be my friend at first. But after a while, they'll get used to me and we'll start sorting ourselves out in the classes. The first ones who will let me get close will be the weaker ones, but that's not a problem. You build your crew based on loyalty first. That's what a shield did. Build loyalty and train them to obey. You work with what you have and go from there. Let them stew on that. Let them think he was trying to turn battle school into the street life that he knew. They'd believe it. And in the meantime, he'd have time to learn as much as he could about how battle school actually worked and come up with a strategy that actually fit the situation.
Dymac came in one last time before lights out. "Your desks keep working after lights out," he said. "But if you use it when you're supposed to be sleeping, we'll know about it, and we'll know what you're doing. So it better be important, or you go on the pig list." Most of the kids put their desks away. A couple of them defiantly kept them out. Bean didn't care either way. He had other things to think about. Plenty of time for the desk tomorrow or the next day. He lay in the near darkness. Apparently the babies here had to have a little light so they could find their way to the toilet without tripping, and listen to the sounds around him, learning what they meant. A few whispers, a few shushes. The breathing of boys and girls as, one by one, they fell asleep. A few even had light child snores. But under those human sounds, the wind sound from the air system, and random clicking and distant voices, sounds of the flexing of a station rotating into and out of sunlight, the sound of adults working through the night. This place was so expensive. Huge, to hold thousands of kids and teachers and staff and crew. As expensive as a ship of the fleet, surely. And all of it just to train little children. The adults may keep the kids wrapped up in a game, but it was serious business to them. This program of training children for war wasn't just some wacko educational theory gone mad, though Sister Carlotta was probably right when she said that a lot of people thought it was. The IF wouldn't maintain it at this level if it weren't expected to give serious results. So these kids snoring and suffing and whispering their way into the darkness, they really mattered. They expect results from me. It's not just a party up here where you come for the food and then do what you want. They really do want to make commanders out of us. And since battle school has been going for a while, they probably have proof that it works. Kids who already graduated and went on to compile a decent service record? That's what I've got to keep in mind. Whatever the system is here, it works. A different sound. Not regular breathing. Jagged little breaths. An occasional gasp. And then a sob. Crying. Some boy was crying himself to sleep. In the nest, Bean had heard some of the kids cry in their sleep, or as they neared sleep. Crying because they were hungry, or injured, or sick, or cold. But what did these kids have to cry about here? Another set of soft sobs joined the first. They're homesick, Bean realized. They've never been away from Mommy and Daddy before, and it's getting to them. Bean just didn't get it. He didn't feel that way about anybody. You just live in the place you're in. You don't worry about where you used to be or where you wish you were. Here is where you are, and here's where you've got to find a way to survive. And lying in bed boo-hooing doesn't help much with that. No problem, though. Their weakness just puts me farther ahead. One less rival on my road to becoming a commander. Is that how Ender Wiggin thought about things? Bean recalled everything he had learned about Ender so far. The kid was resourceful. He didn't openly fight with Bonzo, but he didn't put up with his stupid decisions either. It was fascinating to Bean, because on the street the one rule he knew for sure was, you don't stick your neck out unless your throat's about to be slit anyway. If you have a stupid crew boss, you don't tell him he's stupid, you don't show him he's stupid, you just go along and keep your head down. That's how kids survived. When he had to, Bean had taken a bold risk. Got himself onto Poke's crew that way. But that was about food. That was about not dying. Why did Ender take such a risk when there was nothing at stake but his standing in the war game? Maybe Ender knew something Bean didn't know. Maybe there was some reason why the game was more important than it seemed. Or maybe Ender was one of those kids who just couldn't stand to lose, ever. The kind of kid who's for the team only as long as the team is taking him where he wants to go, and if it isn't, then it's every man for himself.
That's what Bonzo thought. But Bonzo was stupid. Once again, Bean was reminded that there were things he didn't understand. Ender wasn't doing every man for himself. He didn't practice alone. He opened his free time practice to other kids. Launchies, too, not just kids who could do things for him. Was it possible he did that just because it was a decent thing to do? The way Polk had offered herself to a Sheel in order to save Bean's life? No, Bean didn't know that's what she did. He didn't know that's why she died. But the possibility was there, and in his heart he believed it. That was the thing he had always despised about her. She acted tough, but she was soft at heart. And yet, that softness was what saved his life. And try as he might, he couldn't get himself to take the too-bad-for-her attitude that prevailed on the street. She listened to me when I talked to her. She did a hard thing that risked her own life on the chance that it would lead to a better life for all her crew. Then she offered me a place at her table, and in the end, she put herself between me and danger. Why? What was this great secret? Did Ender know it? How did he learn it? Why couldn't Bean figure it out for himself? Try as he might, though, he couldn't understand Polk. He couldn't understand Sister Carlotta either. Couldn't understand the arms she held him with, the tears she shed over him. Didn't they understand that no matter how much they loved him, he was still a separate person, and doing good for him didn't improve their lives in any way? If Ender Wiggin has this weakness, then I will not be anything like him. I am not going to sacrifice myself for anybody. And the beginning of that is that I refuse to lie in my bed and cry for Polk floating there in the water with her throat slit, or boo-hoo because Sister Carlotta isn't asleep in the next room. He wiped his eyes, rolled over, and willed his body to relax and go to sleep. Moments later, he was dozing in that light, easy-to-rouse sleep. Long before morning, his pillow would be dry. He dreamed, as human beings always dream, random firings of memory and imagination that the unconscious mind tries to put together into coherent stories. Bean rarely paid attention to his own dreams, rarely even remembered that he dreamed at all. But this morning he awoke with a clear image in his mind. Ants swarming from a crack in the sidewalk. Little black ants, and larger red ants doing battle with them, destroying them. All of them scurrying, none of them looking up to see the human shoe coming down to stamp the life out of them. When the shoe came back up, what was crushed under it was not ant bodies at all. They were the bodies of children, the urchins from the streets of Rotterdam. All of Ashiel's family. Bean himself. He recognized his own face rising above his flattened body, peering around for one last glimpse at the world before death. Above him loomed the shoe that killed him. But now it was worn on the end of a bugger's leg, and the bugger laughed and laughed. Bean remembered the laughing bugger when he awoke, and remembered the sight of all those children crushed flat, of his own body mashed like gum under a shoe. The meaning was obvious. While we children play at war, the buggers are coming to crush us. We must look above the level of our private struggles and keep in mind the greater enemy. Except that Bean rejected that interpretation of his own dream the moment he thought of it. Dreams have no meaning at all, he reminded himself. And even if they do mean something, it's a meaning that reveals what I feel, what I fear, not some deep abiding truth. So the buggers are coming. So they might crush us all like ants under their feet. What's that to me? My business right now is to keep Bean alive, to advance myself to a position where I might be useful in the war against the buggers. There's nothing I can do to stop them right now. Here's the lesson Bean took from his own dream. Don't be one of the scurrying, struggling ants. Be the shoe.
Sister Carlotta had reached a dead end in her search of the nets. plenty of information on human genetics studies, but nothing like what she was looking for. So she sat there, doodling with a nuisance game on her desk, while trying to think of what to do next, and wondering why she was bothering to look into Bean's beginnings at all, when the secure message arrived from the IF. Since the message would erase itself a minute after arrival, to be resent every minute until it was read by the recipient, she opened it at once and keyed in her first and second passwords. From colonel.graf@battleschool.if to ss.carlotta@specasn.remcon.if. Ray Achilles. Please report all info on Achilles as known to subject. As usual, a message so cryptic that it didn't actually have to be encrypted, though, of course, it had been. This was a secure message, wasn't it? So why not just use the kid's name? Please report on Achille as known to Bean. Somehow Bean had given them the name Achille, and under circumstances such that they didn't want to ask him directly to explain. So it had to be in something he had written. A letter to her? She felt a little thrill of hope, and then scoffed at her own feelings. She knew perfectly well that mail from the kids in battle school was almost never passed along, and besides, the chance of Bean actually writing to her was remote. But they had the name somehow, and wanted to know from her what it meant. The trouble is, she didn't want to give him that information without knowing what it would mean for Bean. So she prepared an equally cryptic reply. Will reply by secure conference only. Of course, this would infuriate Graf, but that was just a perk. Graf was so used to having power far beyond his rank that it would be good for him to have a reminder that all obedience was voluntary and ultimately depended on the free choice of the person receiving the orders. And she would obey, in the end. She just wanted to make sure Bean was not going to suffer from the information. If they knew he had been so closely involved with both the perpetrator and the victim of a murder, they might drop him from the program. And even if she was sure it would be all right to talk about it, she might be able to get a quid pro quo. It took another hour before the secure conference was set up, and when Graf's head appeared in the display above her computer, he was not happy. What game are you playing today, Sister Carlotta?
You've been putting on weight, Colonel Graf. That's not healthy.
Achilles, he said.
Man with a bad heel, she said.
Killed Hector and dragged his body around the gates of Troy. Also had a thing for a captive girl named Briseis.
You know that's not the context.
I know more than that. I know you must have got the name from something Bean wrote, because the name is not pronounced Achilles, it's pronounced Achille.
French. Someone local there.
Dutch is the native language here, though Fleet Common has just about driven it out as anything but a curiosity.
Sister Carlotta, I don't appreciate your wasting the expense of this conference.
And I'm not going to talk about it until I know why you need to know. Graf took a few deep breaths. She wondered if his mother taught him to count to 10, or if, perhaps, he had learned to bite his tongue from dealing with nuns in Catholic school.
We are trying to make sense of something Bean wrote.
Let me see it, and I'll help you as I can.
He's not your responsibility anymore, Sister Carlotta, said Graf.
Then why are you asking me about him? He's your responsibility, yes? So I can get back to work, yes? Graf sighed and did something with his hands out of sight in the display. Moments later, the text of Bean's diary entry appeared on her display below and in front of Graf's face. She read it, smiling slightly. Well? Asked Graf. He's doing a number on you, Colonel.
What do you mean?
He knows you're going to read it. He's misleading you.
You know this?
Ashiel might indeed be providing him with an example, but not a good one. Ashiel once betrayed someone that Bean valued highly.
Don't be vague, Sister Carlotta.
I wasn't vague. I told you precisely what I wanted you to know, just as Bean told you what he wanted you to hear. I can promise you that his diary entries will only make sense to you if you recognize that he is writing these things for you with the intent to deceive.
Why? Because he didn't keep a diary down there?
Because his memory is perfect, said Sister Carlotta. He would never, never commit his real thoughts to a readable form. He keeps his own counsel.
Always.
You will never find a document written by him that is not meant to be read.
Would it make a difference if he was writing it under another identity, which he thinks we don't know about?
But you do know about it, and so he knows you will know about it, so the other identity is there only to confuse you, and it's working.
I forgot. You think this kid is smarter than God.
I'm not worried that you don't accept my evaluation. The better you know him, the more you'll realize that I'm right. You'll even come to believe those test scores.
What will it take to get you to help me with this? Asked Graf.
Try telling me the truth about what this information will mean to Bean.
He's got his primary teacher worried. He disappeared for 21 minutes on the way back from lunch. We have a witness who talked to him on a deck where he had no business, and that still doesn't account for that last 17 minutes of his absence. He doesn't play with his desk.
You think setting up false identities and writing phony diary entries isn't playing?
There's a diagnostic, therapeutic game that all the children play. He hasn't even signed on yet.
He'll know that the game is psychological, and he won't play it until he knows what it will cost him.
Did you teach him that attitude of default hostility?
No, I learned it from him.
Tell me straight. Based on this diary entry, it looks as though he plans to set up his own crew here, as if this were the street. We need to know about this Ashiel, so we'll know what he actually has in mind.
He plans no such thing, said Sister Carlotta.
You say it so forcefully, but without giving me a single reason to trust your conclusion.
You called me, remember?
That's not enough, Sister Carlotta. Your opinions on this boy are suspect.
He would never emulate Ashiel. He would never write his true plans where you could find them. He does not build crews. He joins them and uses them and moves on without a backward glance.
So investigating this Ashiel won't give us a clue about Bean's future behavior?
Bean prides himself on not holding grudges. He thinks they're counterproductive. But at some level, I believe he wrote about Ashiel specifically because you would read what he wrote and would want to know more about Ashiel. And if you investigated him, you would discover a very bad thing that Ashiel did.
To Bean?
To a friend of his.
So he is capable of having friendships.
The girl who saved his life here on the street.
And what's her name?
Polk. But don't bother looking for her. She's dead.
Graf thought about that a moment. Is that the bad thing Ashiel did?
Bean has reason to believe so, though I don't think it would be evidence enough to convict in court. And, as I said, all these things may be unconscious. I don't think Bean would knowingly try to get even with Ashiel, or anybody else for that matter, but he might hope you'd do it for him.
You're still holding back, but I have no choice but to trust your judgment, do I?
I promise you that Ashiel
is a dead end. And if you think of a reason why it might not be so dead after all, I want your program to succeed, Colonel Graf, even more than I want Bean to succeed. My priorities are not skewed by the fact that I do care about the child. I really have told you everything now. But I hope you'll help me also. Information isn't traded in the IF, Sister Carlotta. It flows from those who have it to those who need it. Let me tell you what I want, and you decide if I need it.
Well?
I want to know of any illegal or top-secret projects involving the alteration of the human genome in the past 10 years.
Graf looked off into the distance. It's too soon for you to be off on a new project, isn't it? So this is the same old project. This is about Bean.
He came from somewhere.
You mean his mind came from somewhere?
I mean the whole package. I think you're going to end up relying on this boy, betting all our lives on him, and I think you need to know what's going on in his genes. It's a poor second to knowing what's happening in his mind, but that, I suspect, will always be out of reach for you.
You sent him up here, and then you tell me something like this. Don't you realize that you have just guaranteed that I will never let him move to the top of our selection pool?
You say that now, when you've only had him for a day, said Sister Carlotta. He'll grow on you.
He damn well better not shrink, or he'd get sucked away by the air system.
Tut, tut, Colonel Graf.
Sorry, sister, he answered.
Give me a high enough clearance, and I'll do the search myself.
No, he said. But I'll get summaries sent to you.
She knew that they would give her only as much information as they thought she should have. But when he tried to fob her off with useless drivel, she'd deal with that problem, too. Just as she would try to get to a shield before the IF found him. Get him away from the streets and into a school, under another name. Because if the IF found him, in all likelihood they would test him, or find her scores on him. If they tested him, they would fix his foot and bring him up to battle school. And she had promised Bean that he would never have to face a shield again.
Chapter 8. Good Student.
He doesn't play the fantasy game at all.
He has never so much as chosen a figure, let alone come through the portal.
It's not possible that he hasn't discovered it.
He reset the preferences on his desk so that the invitation no longer pops up.
From which you conclude...
He knows it isn't a game. He doesn't want us analyzing the workings of his mind.
And yet he wants us to advance him.
I don't know that. He buries himself in his studies. For 3 months, he's been getting perfect scores on every test, but he only reads the lesson material once. His study is on other subjects of his own choosing.
Such as?
Vauban.
17th century fortifications? What is he thinking?
You see the problem?
How does he get along with the other children?
I think the classic description is loner. He is polite. He volunteers nothing. He asks only what he's interested in. The kids in his launch group think he's strange. They know he scores better than them on everything, but they don't hate him. They treat him like a force of nature. No friends, but no enemies.
That's important, that they don't hate him. They should if he stays aloof like that.
I think it's a skill he learned on the street, to turn away anger. He never gets angry himself. Maybe that's why the teasing about his size stopped.
Nothing that you're telling me suggests that he has command potential.
If you think he's trying to show command potential and failing at it, then you're right.
So, what do you think he's doing?
Analyzing us.
Gathering information without giving any. Do you really think he's that sophisticated?
He stayed alive on the street.
I think it's time for you to probe a little.
And let him know that his reticence bothers us?
If he's as clever as you think, he already knows.
Bean didn't mind being dirty. He had gone years without bathing, after all. A few days didn't bother him. And if other people minded, they kept their opinions to themselves. Let them add it to the gossip about him. Smaller and younger than Ender. Perfect scores on every test. Stinks like a pig. That shower time was precious. That's when he could sign on to his desk as one of the boys bunking near him, while they were showering. They were naked, wearing only towels to the shower, so their uniforms weren't tracking them. During that time, Bean could sign on and explore the system without letting the teachers know that he was learning the tricks of the system. It tipped his hand just a little when he altered the preferences so he didn't have to face that stupid invitation to play their mind game every time he changed tasks on his desk. But that wasn't a very difficult hack, and he decided they wouldn't be particularly alarmed that he figured it out. So far, Bean had found only a few really useful things, but he felt as though he was on the verge of breaking through more important walls. He knew that there was a virtual system that the students were meant to hack through. He had heard the legends about how Ender, of course, had hacked the system on his first day and signed on as God. But he knew that while Ender might have been unusually quick about it, he wasn't doing anything that wasn't expected of bright, ambitious students. Bean's first achievement was to find the way the teacher's system tracked student computer activity. By avoiding the actions that were automatically reported to the teachers, he was able to create a private file area that they wouldn't see unless they were deliberately looking for it. Then, whenever he found something interesting while signed on as someone else, he would remember the location, then go and download the information into his secure area and work on it at his leisure, while his desk reported that he was reading works from the library. He actually read those works, of course, but far more quickly than his desk reported. With all that preparation, Bean expected to make real progress. But far too quickly he ran into firewalls. Information the system had to have but wouldn't yield. He found several workarounds. For instance, he couldn't find any maps of the whole station, only of the student accessible areas, and those were always diagrammatic and cute, deliberately out of scale. But he did find a series of emergency maps in a program that would automatically display them on the walls of the corridors in the event of a pressure loss emergency, showing the nearest safety locks. These maps were to scale, and by combining them into a single map in his secure area, he was able to create a schema of the whole station. Nothing was labeled except the locks, of course, but he learned of the existence of a parallel system of corridors on either side of the student area. The station must be not one but three parallel wheels, cross-linked at many points. That's where the teachers and staff lived, where the life support was located, the communications with the fleet. The bad news was that they had separate air circulation systems. The ductwork in one would not lead him to either of the others. Which meant that while he could probably spy on anything going on in the student wheel, the other wheels were out of reach. Even within the student wheel, however, there were plenty of secret places to explore. The students had access to four decks, plus the gym below A deck and the battle room above D deck. There were actually nine decks, however, two below A deck and three above D. Those spaces had to be used for something. And if they thought it was worth hiding it from the students, Bean figured it was worth exploring. And he would have to start exploring soon. His exercise was making him stronger, and he was staying lean by not overeating. It was unbelievable how much food they tried to force on him, and they kept increasing his portions, probably because the previous servings hadn't caused him to gain as much weight as they wanted him to gain. But what he could not control was the increase in his height. The ducts would be impassable for him before too long, if they weren't already. Yet using the air system to get him access to the hidden decks was not something he could do during showers. It would mean losing sleep. So he kept putting it off. One day wouldn't make that much difference. Until the morning when Dymac came into the barracks first thing in the morning and announced that everyone was to change his password immediately, with his back turned to the rest of the room, and was to tell no one what the new password was. "Never type it in where anyone can see," he said. "Somebody's been using other people's passwords?" asked a kid, his tone suggesting that he thought this an appalling idea. "Such dishonor!" Bean wanted to laugh. "It's required of all IF personnel, so you might as well develop the habit now," said Dymac. "Anyone found using the same password for more than a week will go on the pig list." But Bean could only assume that they had caught on to what he was doing. That meant they had probably looked back into his probing for the past months and knew pretty much what he had found out. He signed on and purged his secure file area on the chance that they hadn't actually found it yet. Everything he really needed there he had already memorized. He would never rely on the desk again for anything his memory could hold. Stripping and wrapping his towel around him, Bean headed for the showers with the others. But Dymac stopped him at the door. "Let's talk," he said.
"What about my shower?" asked Bean.
"Suddenly you care about cleanliness?" asked Dymac. So Bean expected to be chewed out for stealing passwords. Instead, Dymac sat beside him on a lower bunk near the door and asked him far more general questions. "How are you getting on here?"
"Fine."
"I know your test scores are good, but I'm concerned that you aren't making many friends among the other kids."
"I've got a lot of friends."
"You mean you know a lot of people's names and don't quarrel with anybody?" Bean shrugged. He didn't like this line of questioning any better than he would have liked an inquiry into his computer use. "Bean, the system here was designed for a reason. There are a lot of factors that go into our decisions concerning a student's ability to command. The classwork is an important part of that. But so is leadership."
"Everybody here is just full of leadership ability, right?"
Dymac laughed. "Well, that's true. You can't all be leaders at once."
"I'm about as big as a 3-year-old, said Bean. "I don't think a lot of kids are eager to start saluting me."
"But you could be building networks of friendship. The other kids are. You don't."
"I guess I don't have what it takes to be a commander."
Dymac raised an eyebrow. "Are you suggesting you want to be iced? Do my test scores look like I'm trying to fail?" "What do you want?" asked Dymac. "You don't play the games the other kids play. Your exercise program is weird, even though you know the regular program is designed to strengthen you for the battle room. Does that mean you don't intend to play that game either? Because if that's your plan, you really will get iced. That's our primary means of assessing command ability. That's why the whole life of the school is centered around the armies."
"I'll do fine in the battle room," said Bean.
"If you think you can do it without preparation, you're mistaken. A quick mind is no replacement for a strong, agile body. You have no idea how physically demanding the battle room can be."
"I'll join the regular workouts, sir."
Dymac leaned back and closed his eyes with a small sigh. "My, but you're compliant, aren't you, Bean?"
"I try to be, sir."
"That is such complete bullshit," said Dymac.
"Sir?"
"Here it comes," thought Bean. "If you devoted the energy to making friends that you devote to hiding things from the teachers, you'd be the most beloved kid in the school."
"That would be Ender Wiggin, sir."
"And don't think we haven't picked up on the way you obsess about Wiggin."
"Obsess?"
Bean hadn't asked about him after that first day. Never joined in discussions about the standings. Never visited the battle room during Ender's practice sessions.
"Oh. What an obvious mistake. Stupid.
You're the only Launchy who has completely avoided so much as seeing Ender Wiggin. You track his schedule so thoroughly that you are never in the same room with him. That takes real effort."
"I'm a Launchy, sir. He's in an army."
"Don't play dumb, Bean. It's not convincing, and it wastes my time." Tell a useless and obvious truth, that was the rule. "Everyone compares me to Ender all the time because I came here so young and small. I wanted to make my own way."
I'll accept that for now because there's a limit to how deeply I want to wade into your bullshit, said Dymac. But in saying what he'd said about Ender, Bean wondered if it might not be true. Why shouldn't I have such a normal emotion as jealousy? I'm not a machine. So he was a little offended that Dymac seemed to assume that something more subtle had to be going on, that Bean was lying no matter what he said. Tell me, said Dymac, why you refuse to play the fantasy game. It looks boring and stupid, said Bean. That was certainly true. Not good enough, said Dymac. For one thing, it isn't boring and stupid to any other kid in battle school. In fact, the game adapts itself to your interests. I have no doubt of that, thought Bean. It's all pretending, said Bean. None of it's real. Stop hiding for one second, can't you? Snapped Dymac. You know perfectly well that we use the game to analyze personality, and that's why you refuse to play. Sounds like you've analyzed my personality anyway, said Bean. You just don't let up, do you? Bean said nothing. There was nothing to say. I've been looking at your reading list, said Dymac. Vauban? Yes? Fortification engineering from the time of Louis XIV. Bean nodded. He thought back to Vauban and how his strategies had adapted to fit Louis's ever more straitened finances. Defense in depth had given way to a thin line of defenses. Building new fortresses had largely been abandoned, while raising redundant or poorly placed ones continued. Poverty triumphing over strategy. He started to talk about this, but Dymac cut him off. Come on, Bean. Why are you studying a subject that has nothing to do with war in space? Bean didn't really have an answer. He had been working through the history of strategy from Xenophon and Alexander to Caesar and Machiavelli. Vauban came in sequence. There was no plan. Mostly his readings were a cover for his clandestine computer work. But now that Dymac was asking him, what did 17th century fortifications have to do with war in space? I'm not the one who put Vauban in the library. We have the full set of military writings that are found in every library in the fleet. Nothing more significant than that. Bean shrugged. You spent 2 hours on Vauban. So what? I spent as long on Frederick the Great, and I don't think we're doing field drills either, or bayoneting anyone who breaks ranks during a march into fire. You didn't actually read Vauban, did you? Said Dymac. So I want to know what you were doing. I was reading Vauban. You think we don't know how fast you read? And thinking about Vauban? All right, then. What were you thinking? Like you said, about how it applies to war in space. Buy some time here. What does Vauban have to do with war in space? I'm waiting, said Dymac. Give me the insights that occupied you for 2 hours just yesterday. Well, of course, fortifications are impossible in space, said Bean. In the traditional sense, that is. But there are things you can do. Like his mini fortresses, where you leave a sallying force outside the main fortification. You can station squads of ships to intercept raiders. And there are barriers you can put up, mines, fields of flotsam to cause collisions with fast-moving ships, hulling them, that sort of thing. Dymac nodded, but said nothing. Bean was beginning to warm to the discussion. The real problem is that unlike Vauban, we have only one strong point worth defending. Earth. And the enemy is not limited to a primary direction of approach. He could come from anywhere, all at once. So we run into the classic problem of defense, cubed. The farther out you deploy your defenses, the more of them you have to have, and if your resources are limited, you soon have more fortifications than you can man. What good are bases on moons of Jupiter or Saturn or Neptune when the enemy doesn't even have to come in on the plane of the ecliptic? He can bypass all our fortifications.
The way Nimitz and MacArthur used two-dimensional island hopping against the defense and depth of the Japanese in World War II. Only our enemy can work in three dimensions. Therefore, we cannot possibly maintain defense in depth. Our only defense is early detection and a single massed force. Dymac nodded slowly. His face showed no expression. Go on. Go on? That wasn't enough to explain 2 hours of reading? Well, so I thought that even that was a recipe for disaster, because the enemy is free to divide his forces. So even if we intercept and defeat 99 of 100 attacking squadrons, he only has to get one squadron through to cause terrible devastation on Earth. We saw how much territory a single ship could scour when they first showed up and started burning over China. Get 10 ships to Earth for a single day? And if they spread us out enough, they'd have a lot more than a day, and they could wipe out most of our main population centers. All our eggs are in that one basket. And all this you got from Vauban, said Dymac. Finally. That was apparently enough to satisfy him. From thinking about Vauban, and how much harder our defensive problem is. So, said Dymac, what's your solution? Solution? What did Dymac think Bean was? I'm thinking about how to get control of the situation here in battle school, not how to save the world. I don't think there is a solution, said Bean, buying time again. But then having said it, he began to believe it. There's no point in trying to defend Earth at all. In fact, unless they have some defensive device we don't know about, like some way of putting an invisible shield around a planet or something, the enemy is just as vulnerable. So the only strategy that makes any sense at all is an all-out attack. To send our fleet against their homeworld and destroy it. What if our fleets pass in the night? Asked Dymac. We destroy each other's worlds and all we have left are ships? No, said Bean, his mind racing. Not if we sent out a fleet immediately after the second Bugger War. After Maser Rackham's strike force defeated them, it would take time for word of their defeat to come back to them. So we build a fleet as quickly as possible and launch it against their home world immediately. That way the news of their defeat reaches them at the same time as our devastating counterattack. Dymac closed his eyes. Now you tell us. No, said Bean, as it dawned on him that he was right about everything. That fleet was already sent. Before anybody on this station was born, that fleet was launched. Interesting theory, said Dymac. Of course you're wrong on every point. No, I'm not, said Bean. He knew he wasn't wrong because Dymac's air of calm was not holding. Sweat was standing out on his forehead. Bean had hit on something really important here, and Dymac knew it. I mean, your theory is right about the difficulty of defense in space. But hard as it is, we still have to do it, and that's why you're here. As to some fleet we supposedly launched. The second Bugger War exhausted humanity's resources, Bean. It's taken us this long to get a reasonable-sized fleet again, and to get better weaponry for the next battle. If you learned anything from Vauban, you should have learned that you can't build more than your people have resources to support. Besides which, you're assuming we know where the enemy's home world is. But your analysis is good insofar as you've identified the magnitude of the problem we face. Dymac got up from the bunk. It's nice to know that your study time isn't completely wasted on breaking into the computer system, he said. With that parting shot, he left the barracks. Bean got up and walked back to his own bunk, where he got dressed. No time for a shower now, and it didn't matter anyway, because he knew that he had struck a nerve in what he said to Dymac. The second Bugger War hadn't exhausted humanity's resources. Bean was sure of that.
The problems of defending a planet were so obvious that the IF couldn't possibly have missed them, especially not in the aftermath of a nearly lost war. They knew they had to attack. They built the fleet. They launched it. It was gone. It was inconceivable that they had done anything else. So what was all this nonsense with the battle school for? Was Dymac right? That battle school was simply about building up the defensive fleet around Earth to counter any enemy assault that might have passed our invasion fleet on the way? If that were true, there would be no reason to conceal it. No reason to lie. In fact, all the propaganda on Earth was devoted to telling people how vital it was to prepare for the next bugger invasion. So Dymac had done nothing more than repeat the story that the IF had been telling everybody on Earth for 3 generations. Yet Dymac was sweating like a fish, which suggested that the story wasn't true. The defensive fleet around Earth was already fully manned. That was the problem. The normal process of recruitment would have been enough. Defensive war didn't take brilliance, just alertness. Early detection, cautious interception, protection of an adequate reserve. Success depended not on the quality of command, but on the quantity of available ships and the quality of the weaponry. There was no reason for battle school. Battle school only made sense in the context of an offensive war, a war where maneuver, strategy, and tactics would play an important role. But the offensive fleet was already gone. For all Bean knew, the battle had already been fought years ago, and the IF was just waiting for news about whether we had won or lost. It all depended on how many light years away the bugger home planet was. For all we know, thought Bean, the war is already over. The IF knows that we won, and they simply haven't told anybody. And the reason for that was obvious. The only thing that had ended war on Earth and bound together all of humanity was a common cause: defeating the buggers. As soon as it was known that the bugger threat was eliminated, all the pent-up hostilities would be released. Whether it was the Muslim world against the West, or long-restrained Russian imperialism and paranoia against the Atlantic Alliance, or Indian adventurism, or all of them at once. Chaos. The resources of the international fleet would be co-opted by mutinying commanders from one faction or another. Conceivably, it could mean the destruction of Earth, without any help from the Formics at all. That's what the IF was trying to prevent. The terrible cannibalistic war that would follow. Just as Rome tore itself apart in civil war after the final elimination of Carthage. Only far worse, because the weapons were more terrible and the hatreds far deeper. National and religious hatreds rather than the mere personal rivalries among leading citizens of Rome. The IF was determined to prevent it. In that context, battle school made perfect sense. For many years, almost every child on Earth had been tested, and those with any potential brilliance in military command were taken out of their homeland and put into space. The best of the battle school graduates, or at least those most loyal to the IF, might very well be used to command armies when the IF finally announced the end of the war and struck preemptively to eliminate national armies and unify the world, finally and permanently, under one government. But the main purpose of the battle school was to get these kids off Earth so that they could not become commanders of the armies of any one nation or faction. After all, the invasion of France by the major European powers after the French Revolution led to the desperate French government discovering and promoting Napoleon, even though in the end he seized the reins of power instead of just defending the nation. The IF was determined that there would be no Napoleons on Earth to lead the resistance. All the potential Napoleons were here, wearing silly uniforms and battling each other for supremacy in a stupid game. It was all pig lists. By taking us, they have tamed the world. If you don't get dressed, you'll be late for class, said Nikolai, the boy who slept on the bottommost bunk directly across from Bean. Thanks, said Bean. He shed his dry towel and hurriedly pulled on his uniform.
Sorry I had to tell them about your using my password, said Nikolai.
Bean was dumbfounded.
I mean, I didn't know it was you, but they started asking me what I was looking for in the emergency map system. And since I didn't know what they were talking about, it wasn't hard to guess that somebody was signing on as me. And there you are, in the perfect place to see my desk whenever I sign on, and...
I mean, you're really smart.
But it's not like I set out to tell on you.
That's fine, said Bean. Not a problem.
But, I mean, what did you find out? From the maps?
Until this moment, Bean would have blown off the question. And the boy.
Nothing much. I was just curious. That's what he would have said. But now his whole world had changed. Now it mattered that he have connections with the other boys. Not so he could show his leadership ability to the teachers, but so that when war did break out on Earth, and when the IF's little plan failed, as it was bound to do, he would know who his allies and enemies were among the commanders of the various national and factional armies. For the IF's plan would fail. It was a miracle it hadn't failed already. It depended too heavily on millions of soldiers and commanders being more loyal to the IF than to their homeland. It would not happen. The IF itself would break up into factions, inevitably. But the plotters no doubt were aware of that danger. They would have kept the number of plotters as small as possible. Perhaps only the triumvirate of Hegemon, Strategos, and Polemarch, and maybe a few people here at Battle School. Because this station was the heart of the plan. Here was where every single gifted commander for two generations had been studied intimately. There were records on every one of them. Who was most talented, most valuable. What their weaknesses were, both in character and in command. Who their friends were. What their loyalties were. Which of them, therefore, should be approached to command the IF's forces in the intra-human wars to come, and which should be stripped of command and held incommunicado until hostilities were over. No wonder they were worried about Bean's lack of participation in their little mind game. It made him an unknown quantity. It made him dangerous. But it was even more dangerous for Bean to play than ever. Not playing might make them suspicious and fearful, but in whatever move they planned against him, at least they wouldn't know anything about him. While if he did play, then they might be less suspicious, but if they did move against him, they would do it knowing whatever information the game gave to them. And Bean was not at all confident of his ability to outplay the game. Even if he tried to give them misleading results, that strategy in itself might tell them more about him than he wanted them to know. And there was another possibility, too. He might be completely wrong. There might be key information that he did not have. Maybe no fleet had been launched. Maybe they hadn't defeated the buggers at their homeworld. Maybe there really was a desperate effort to build a defensive fleet. Maybe, maybe, maybe. Bean had to get more information in order to have some hope that his analysis was correct and that his choices would be valid. And Bean's isolation had to end. Nikolai, said Bean, you wouldn't believe what I've found out from those maps. Did you know there are 9 decks, not just 4? 9? And that's just in this wheel. There are 2 other wheels they never tell us about. But the pictures of the station show only the one wheel. Those pictures were all taken when there was only one wheel. But in the plans, there are 3, parallel to each other, turning together. Nikolai looked thoughtful. But that's just the plans. Maybe they never built those other wheels. Then why would they still have maps for them in the emergency system? Nikolai laughed. My father always said, bureaucrats never throw anything away. Of course. Why hadn't he thought of that? The emergency map system was no doubt programmed before the first wheel was ever brought into service. So all those maps would already be in the system, even if the other wheels were never built, even if 2/3 of the maps would never have a corridor wall to be displayed on. No one would bother to go into the system and clean them out.
I never thought of that, said Bean.
He knew, given his reputation for brilliance, that he could pay Nikolai no higher compliment, as indeed the reaction of the other kids in nearby bunks showed. No one had ever had such a conversation with Bean before. No one had ever thought of something that Bean hadn't obviously thought of first. Nikolai was blushing with pride.
But the 9 decks? That makes sense, said Nikolai.
Wish I knew what was on them, said Bean.
Life support, said the girl named Corn Moon. They got to be making oxygen somewhere here. That takes a lot of plants.
More kids joined in. And staff. All we ever see are teachers and nutritionists.
And maybe they did build the other wheels. We don't know they didn't.
The speculation ran rampant through the group. And at the center of it all, Bean. Bean and his new friend Nikolai.
Come on, said Nikolai. We'll be late for math.